values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
All right, joining me in studio from the Arizona Farm Bureau, their Strategic Communication Director, Julie Murfree. Julie, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. If it's Arizona agriculture, I'm always going to talk about it.
Well, it's, and I also think that it's fitting because today is Earth Day. And if you really want to talk to someone that, in my opinion, that is a true environmentalist and a conservationist, it's the people that live and work off the land. And your family's been doing it for your entire life and beyond, even before that.
Correct. In fact, we like to say about Earth Day is every day on the farm and the ranch.
Yeah, and the ranch. And I appreciate you doing this. The reason why is we've been hearing all of these stories about inflation. And I read a story last week that talked about how inflation is impacting the farmers in Arizona and how smaller farms especially are in danger of not existing anymore because they just can't keep up with inflation. Can you explain a little bit of that?
Sure, but I have to say something. I know you've heard this phrase. I got to start with a metaphor for the farmer. He's the only person in our economy who has to buy everything at retail, sell everything he sells wholesale, and pay for the freight both ways. And, you know, there's so much truth to that. And if you have met farmers or grown up on a farm, you get that. But the impact is there. So let's just consider the typical input cost to a farm. There's fertilizer. There's interest payments, interest expenses, and I guarantee you every farm and ranch, there's probably a loan somewhere with equipment or something. Pesticides, livestock, fuel and oil, animal feed, taxes, repair and maintenance, marketing, storage and transportation, seed, labor and rent. So we have a lot of input costs.
And no control over when those costs skyrocket.
Right. And they have skyrocketed. If you look at inflation over the last 3 years, it's highest in the fertilizer, 78% if you calculate that from 2020 to 2023. So in this inflationary period, in this last 3 to 4 years, it's huge on the farm.
And I would have thought that the biggest impact or a biggest increase would have been in fuel. That would have been my guess. I would have never guessed it was fertilizer.
It's gone up, but not to what you would think. I mean, when you think it's an increase over those last 3 years of 35%, that's huge. But the biggest increases have been in fertilizer, interest expenses, pesticides, livestock. And again, fuel and oil at 35%, animal feed at 32%, taxes. You know, we were talking about that before the show started. Yep. Everybody's got to pay taxes. There's an increase 20% there. So everything has gone up. And while previously in the last 2 years, our commodity prices went up, everybody said, oh, the farmer's doing fine. But if you calculate a 78% increase on your fertilizer, you know, that's still, that net profit is still going to be in that 1 or 2%. It's, yeah, and it varies. I mean, we're not price makers, we're price takers on the commodity market. So our family, through 2004, we grew cotton, wheat, and alfalfa. So we were price takers. We couldn't make it. Now, if I'm an organic farmer, a lot of times, or certainly in the direct market farms, you were talking about the small farms, the direct market farms, they can kind of set their price because there's some increased costs even when you do organic. So it's all a factor of what they have to spend in order to conduct business.
And the risk is there because there are so many variables with weather and other things that you can't account for. But the risk level there for the farmers is immense because all it takes is a bad year or a mistake or something to go wrong.
Right.
And there is no profit. Then they're underwater. Then they're on the opposite side of that. And when you have a crop, you talked about cotton, and correct me if I'm wrong, cotton and alfalfa are both very water heavy crops. So therefore, when it's hard to get water, access to water, or the expense of water, doesn't that also add to the expense immensely?
It does, but we have gotten so dramatically sophisticated with our water inputs with these crops, and because they are such high production, the water cost isn't as much of a factor as some of the other input costs that I mentioned to you. So that's a piece of good news for us. The other aspect of all of this is it makes you realize why less than 2% of the population is in farming. These individuals that I know personally that I meet on a weekly basis, I'm going to go to Yuma on Friday to interview this one brilliant young farmer in Yuma, Kirk Dunn. And they have to be sophisticated about their business or they're not going to survive. And another little caveat I'll tell you about Arizona Farm Bureau. So we used to do a quarterly market basket for the consumer to let them know if we were up in price or down in price. I've suspended that until we get through this inflationary period because unlike the news, I don't want to always have bad news.
Right.
So it's just been that tough. It's been that tough for you and I in our pocketbooks. It's been that tough for the farmers and the ranchers, but we prevail. And another key element I like to tell individuals about our farmers and ranchers and their business acumen, they prepare and set aside in the good times. So during the bad times, they know how to survive. Another thing about our family farms is they're very sophisticated about their diversity. They don't just grow one crop. A lot of them are in both livestock and crop agriculture. So that diversity allows them to survive. Maybe this commodity is down, but this commodity is up. So there's a lot of things, and they're very sophisticated with their risk management, including buying crop insurance to kind of say, to prepare for a rainy day or struggles like that. So we're talking, they're all family farms here in Arizona. I think it's 96% of our farms in the state of Arizona are family farms, but they're incorporated or they're an LLC to protect themselves. If they don't, they're not going to survive this.
Julie Murphy is joining us. She is the Strategic Communication Director for the Arizona Farm Bureau. Is there a lot of pressure in the farming industry with the immense growth we've seen? It seems like more and more we're seeing around the valley, you'll see a farm right next to an incoming housing development, and sooner or later you're going to see it all be housing. Is there a lot of pressure in your industry for housing and to people to buy up that land? And what does that mean for us as consumers with healthy food and vegetables and the things we eat if it continues to go that direction?
Right. It's tough pressure. And for me personally, because our family farmed, like I said earlier, through 2004, it's kind of heartbreaking because literally the farmhouse that I grew up is now a lake in a development. So that is kind of discouraging. But on the encouraging side, and that's what I want your listeners to know, is we actually are doing more with less. We are growing double, triple, and often quadruple in 1 acre. That's our size of measurement in the farming community. An acre is basically a football field. We're doing more in that 1 acre than we've ever done before. And that's because of improved seed, the way we manage our fertilizer and water applications. So our yields are way better today than they used to be. So despite the fact that maybe you and I see land going into development because of some of the sophisticated ways we're trying to farm today, we're doing a lot more with less.
So the last question then is about sustainability. Should people in Arizona feel good about the future? Do you believe that the situation for, as you're talking about, the family farms here in Arizona, do you see security in the food industry, in whether it's livestock or it's the food you grow? Do you see that it's the future is still pretty bright and solid?
I do. I absolutely do. You know, we grow and we become innovative and struggle. And one thing I'll always tell you about agriculture, we definitely feel the struggles. But the other reason I'm very encouraged is the USDA Census of Ag just released, and my economist friend with the land-grant university at U of A is crunching those numbers, and he and his team are going to analyze, this is George Frisfold, going to analyze those numbers, and then bring in other data sets related to Arizona, and he is confident that $23.3 billion industry will potentially be even larger. And again, part of it is just the robustness of our commitment to very sophisticated agriculture. And, you know, if anybody's ever curious about our sustainability issues or our conservation issues, just go to Arizona Farm Bureau's webpage, azfb.org. You know, plug in conservation, plug in sustainability, and you'll learn a lot about what our farmers are doing. And like in ranching, some of the conservation practices that ranchers do, if you go to their drink tanks where they water their cattle and also the wildlife,
yeah,
they're using solar. And they've been using solar for decades. So we're very Earth Day focused, and we have been for decades. And I guarantee you we were Earth Day focused prior to Earth Day. And again, part of that, when we go back to these input costs, It's because they're so expensive. Sure. And we've got to be sophisticated in the way we manage our businesses on the farm and the ranch.
It is a pleasure to meet you. I appreciate you coming by, and I'd love to do this on a more regular basis. I think it is a misinformed industry that people don't know enough about it, and I'd love you to have you come back.
Mike, I'm honored to be here. I love your show, and it's great that you invited us.
All right, that is Julie Murphy from the Arizona Farm Bureau. We'll be back in just a moment.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, so public school enrollment. There's a lot we're going to get to today. We're bouncing around a lot, but there are so many important topics. This is a busy Monday news-wise. Public school enrollment falling nationwide according to data. And there's a lot of different things in here. Census Bureau data shows K through 12 enrollment continues in a downward trajectory in 2022. Experts say it's more than just a decline in birth rates. And I just think that this is a part of the morphing of education. I talk about education a lot. I want to be very clear in this, that I am not against public education. As a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. I want to see a thriving public education system. I just think public education is not changing the way it needs to. Every single industry, every industry is changing, including education. I point to Dr. Michael Crow at ASU. It has been known as the most innovative institution, I believe, in the world, but it's certainly in the country. For years, Michael Crow understood coming to Arizona State University that education was going to change and it needed to change at ASU. You look at the engineering program. You look at what they're doing for K through 12 education at Arizona State University. They are making really big changes and have all along that he is willing to break what is known as the traditional rules if he believes it's going to lead to better education. And it's proving to be very advantageous at the college level, but also at the K through 12 level in Arizona. School choice has become very popular. I want to go back to an old adage. I've talked about this many times. Most families would want their children to grow up in the neighborhood school. It may be romantic for you in a sense if your children go to the school you went to. I grew up in a neighborhood or an area, and I bounced around quite a bit when my parents got divorced, but I lived in the same area. I went to the same high school. I'm the oldest. My middle brother, Tom, who is the one I lost in Iraq, but Tom also went to the same high school I did. Our youngest brother, who is 7 years younger than me, had an opportunity as a scholarship kid to go to a school like a Brophy, but he would have gone to the same school. I still keep in touch with and am very close with my friends. I'm going home in May, and we are already setting up with the friends I've known since middle school to continue to get together every time I'm in town. We all still remain very close. The same memories of the football games and proms and homecoming and parties and all the things kids do. That is what most people want for their child. The kids you play with in the neighborhood growing up as young kids, as you grow together and ride the school bus together and you go through the same things in a classroom setting, it builds a community. But when the quality of education is not what it's supposed to be, when a parent sees their child is floundering, what takes precedent over that stable atmosphere is a quality education so their child has an opportunity to thrive as an adult. So school choice is going to remain something that is good. And I would hope, it is my hope, that public educators, that the teachers' organizations and some of the other anti-school choice organizations get on board with school choice, do your best to influence it in a positive way in your mind instead of being so resistant against it, because school choice is happening. You are seeing chronic absenteeism, and I've got some examples. You've got
coverage.
You have got a North Carolina student charged with assault after allegedly slapping a teacher. I talked about this video. This kid, the teacher is seated. This kid walks up, and he's a very young student. I think he was 14 years old. I think is how old he is. And I don't know if it says it in here or if I'm just guessing that he's 14 years old. This student walked up and slapped his teacher in the face and was yelling at this teacher. The teacher never stands up. She stays seated. And he says, "Do you want me to hit you again?" And she said, no, she didn't want to be hit again. And he said, "Nobody's coming to help you." And he's cursing her out. And he open hand slaps her with the other hand so hard it knocks her glasses across the room. Well, that kid has been suspended. They're looking for expulsion. But at the end of this story, there are teachers that are from that school that said, "I'm not surprised. The deterioration of behavior." And here's the other part of this. I would venture to say that a student that is so brazen that he would slap a teacher That's not the first behavioral problem you had with a kid. If you put them in check in kindergarten and first grade, by the time they get to be this age, they've learned you, it won't be tolerated in schools. You don't wait for a violent assault against a teacher. Arizona K through 12 schools and police face flood of gun threats, lockdowns, and guns. So it is the reason why I bring these stories up is schools are not necessarily seen as safe. The city of Phoenix, the Phoenix Union High School District, decided that it wasn't going to have school resource officers on campus because there were some students that didn't feel comfortable around the police. Well, there are some students that shouldn't feel comfortable around police, and it has nothing to do with the color of their skin. It has everything to do with their behavior. That good students and good teachers deserve an environment where they can learn and teach in safety. And if you're a bad kid, if you're a distraction, you should be gone. You should be asked to leave. You should be given an opportunity to go somewhere else. But the school should be focused that if you are a child that wants to learn, you have a safe place to sit in a classroom and learn. If you're a teacher, you should not have to worry about violence against you or watching it happen to a student because the school is out of control and cannot police what the behavior of the students are. That's a big piece of this. And so, you know, I'm never going to get off this topic. We'll talk about it later on in the show because I think it's a very important one. In a moment, we're going to go back to the border, but in a different way. Undocumented college students are speaking out about their situation. I'm undocumented and I'm in college. And then what they had to say about that and the future, that's what we'll discuss next.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, the 2024 Phoenix Go Red for Women luncheon takes place on May 3rd at the JW Marriott Scottsdale Camelback Inn and Resort and Spa. Join us as we go red for women. Visit heart.org/PHX Go Red to learn more or register. So here is the headline from a USA Today story. I'm undocumented and in college. My story is more common than you think. It's the future. And I think this is absolutely on point and 100% correct. Thanks to a 2022 measure granting in-state tuition, Arizona students like me have a chance to prove we belong in the education system. Here is the issue I have. I will tell you that I think the plight of the Dreamers is a real one. Two presidents ago, the Dream Act was passed. Whether you agree with it or you didn't, you have kids that were raised as Americans. I just spent a day or an evening with a bunch of people talking about the immigration issue. One of them is a Dreamer. He's in his 30s now. He's been here in this country, in the state of Arizona, for over 30 years. He was brought here as a two-year-old. He was brought here by his grandparents and I think his mother. And brought here illegally, raised in an American school, went to, I believe, Arizona State University, and is a very successful person. But he's limited on what he can do. He can't leave the country, he could travel outside the country, couldn't come back. And I will say this is the perfect example of what is wrong with the American immigration system. Our border security issue is what leads to it, but our immigration system is a mess. We've created the next generation of dreamers. And I will tell you that there are hardliners out there that say, too bad. Your parents brought you here. They should have known better. You have to go back. You're not entitled. And I'm telling you that as Americans, we're not going to do that. As frustrated as we've gotten with the system, and I'm more frustrated than anyone else, as Americans, we are not going to tell somebody that's 32 or 33 years old that the only place you've ever lived your entire life is the U.S., and now you have to go back to another country. I don't think it's going to happen. But what we should also be doing is looking what a messed up system it is and not putting it on our children and our grandchildren to deal with it in a bigger way. We have over 8 million people that have come to this country illegally in the last few years. They're waiting in lines that could be 10 years long. So you've got someone that comes across, let's say it's a family, and they come across together and they come across and apply for asylum. They wait in line. They've got a 10-year wait, which means the kids are going to go to an American school. The family is going to put down roots. They're going to give friends or whatever. If you've got children that may, you may have other children now that are born in America. If you come as an individual, you may find a spouse and get married and start having children within that 10-year period. And then what are we going to do? We find out that your asylum claim was rejected, that you had no legal right to asylum in the U.S. Then what do we do as Americans? Then are we horrible people because we tell you you have to leave? That's exactly what the narrative says. So why are we not doing something about this now? But this headline is correct. It's not uncommon, and it is the future, that we are going to see this more and more often. And I don't agree with the principle or the premise when somebody says, well, what we should do is just give everybody entry that's here now. Let's clear the slate and tell everybody they're citizens. What we have done is two things. Both are wrong. One is we are incentivizing illegal behavior, which is wrong. And secondly, we are telling the people that are doing it the right way, that are waiting in line the right way, we are telling them, you're dumb. Why would you do that? Why would you spend all that money? Why would you spend all that time? Why don't you just come across the border and do it the way we did it? You're going to get free food and shelter for 6 months at a minimum. Many people say that that's not long enough. You're going to be able to be put on your feet. You're going to get an opportunity here in America. If you've got children, they're immediately going to be enrolled in American schools. I just saw my friend yesterday who is trying to get his fiance here. They have a 4-year-old daughter together who is an American citizen. The daughter is an American citizen. She has a social security card, but she's lived with her mother in Mexico her entire life. So he could bring his daughter here, but then she wouldn't be with her mom. You're not going to separate a 4-year-old from the only parent they've ever lived with. So he's trying to do it the right way. In the meantime, he's paying for a private school in Mexico so his daughter can get the best education she can there, but she's not being educated in American schools. They're spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and waiting months and months and months and months to have to prove they have a real relationship and background checks and everything else that you're supposed to go through to gain entry legally into the U.S. And they're doing it the right way. He goes to Mexico at least once a month. He spends the weekend with his family. Then he comes back to the U.S. He's doing everything the right way. And he's watching all of these people being just given a pass and told you have at least 10 years or 8 years or whatever it's going to be before you're hearing. It's not right. It is, as a matter of fact, it's not only is it not right, it's absolutely wrong. New York Home Depot hires guards and dogs to keep parking lots safe from thieves and aggressive migrants. The Denver Migrant Advocate says 6 months of free rent and food is not enough and a slap in the face and offensive. Denver area schools struggle to absorb surge in migrant refugee children. They fled Venezuela and now they're transformed DC's food delivery scene. These are some of the headlines and what's happening. We are ruining the reputation of immigration in the United States with what's happening. Everyone's called a migrant and they're not. Most of the people are illegal migrants. They are coming here illegally. And by not making a designation, as a matter of fact, it's even worse. We are now hearing when I say migrants, if I said illegal immigrant, there are people that kind of, they kind of get a little offended when you say illegal immigrant. So then you call someone illegal migrant, an undocumented migrant. Well, even that's not good anymore. Then it was migrant. Everybody's just a migrant. We know what you mean. But don't use the word illegal. That's offensive to some. Let's call them all migrants. Now they're called newcomers. Let's just call them newcomers. Much nicer. And what we have done is we have taken away the accomplishment of doing it the right way. I am someone that would stand shoulder to shoulder with you and say, we have got to fix the immigration system in the U.S. I agree with you. We do. But it starts with border security. And we don't say to people, just because it's not as easy as it should right now doesn't mean you're allowed to break the law to do it. And if we don't do that, if we don't start doing that, we are going to be in big trouble. We already are in big trouble. Billions of dollars in state budgets trying to fix this issue. All right. It is Earth Day. So what we're going to do in a moment is we're going to talk about it. Is it an important time? Why is it important? But also recycling. That's a big part of what we do. How much of what you throw away in Arizona, how much is actually recycled? And what is the dirty secret about recycling around the country? We're going to talk specifically about Earth Day coming up here in just a moment.
Values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
All right, I wanted to take a look at Earth Day. People think I'm joking when I say this. I consider myself to be an environmentalist, and I always have. I grew up in a place that was absolutely beautiful. Florida is known for its beaches, but if you go inland, it is very agriculture-rich, cattle and farming. And the Everglades are, so if you want to go to a place and see just diversity in wildlife, absolutely scary at times, terrifying at times, but some of the most beautiful views you will ever see, go to the Everglades. Then I moved to Arizona and I visited, you know, you cannot go to Sedona and not have your breath taken away. The Grand Canyon. I love the White Mountains. I love to drive up to the White Mountains. The desert is just beautiful. So I consider myself an environmentalist. I really do. I want this to remain pristine and beautiful for years to come. In spite of our growth, I don't want to lose our character. I want to maintain clean water. I want water to be available for generations. I want the same thing for clean air. I want everything that everybody else wants. Earth Day is different in my mind, and it is a day I don't know, it's supposed to be a day that celebrates our environmentalist in us, but what is it turned into? I want you to hear a couple of news stories about environmental projects and the people's, as far as voters' concerns about the environment. This is Mary Alice Parks from ABC.
Her project is targeting environmentally conscious citizens, often young people and people of color, who rarely head to the polls.
And that's our biggest problem in the climate movement right now. We don't have enough voting power.
The group's founder, Nathaniel Stinnett, says they've had some success.
We've sometimes increased turnout as much as 1.8 percentage points in general elections, 3.6 points in primaries, and 5.7 points in local elections.
That doesn't sound like a lot.
Ask Donald Trump how big a deal 1.8% is in Pennsylvania, and I'll tell you.
So when you look at this, this is the part of it, the political movement that is environmentalism. I'm going to get to the point of all this in a moment. This is same interview talking about climate change, not on the top of mind for voters.
The group is nonpartisan, though acknowledges it's almost exclusively Democrats right now working to address climate change. They hope they can push Republicans to come to the table too. But that's no easy task. Across the board this election, registered voters list immigration, the economy, abortion, and democracy as their top issues, with climate change not even making the top 10.
Because they have made it overtly political. That's what this is all about. There is no conversation. There is no disagreement. I can say I'm an environmentalist, but I think what you're doing with this push in the way you're doing it is wrong. And all of a sudden I'm ostracized that I don't care. So isn't this interesting? In Arizona, in the valley, Arizona only recycles about 17% of its waste. Only about 17%. Here's a national headline, the troubling truth about the country's recycling program. Imagine diligently separating your recyclables, placing them into green bins as instructed, or here we do it in blue bins, then discovering it's all for naught. That's the frustrating thing about this. That the green dumpsters was just a facade and the company didn't even offer residential recycling. It begs the question, is anyone else's complex out there lying about something so obvious? You have so many people that want to be environmentally friendly, including myself. I get shouted down when I say something like this because I don't buy into the environmentalist political movement that's out there. I grew up in an environmentally friendly place. They would always make room. You had to have dark sky ordinances in the backyards. People couldn't have lights on the backs of their homes if you lived on the water. The reason why, when turtles are hatched, they hatch at night. And when sea turtles hatch at night, they move toward the moonlight glistening off the water. And that's how they know to get to the water to survive. If there are lights on the backs of homes, they see that in the wrong direction. They head in the wrong direction and they die. burrowing owls take precedent. If you have a piece of land and you're building a home and a burrowing owl nests on your land, your construction site is set shut down until those hatchlings, until those chicks hatch, and then they fly away. Those are all kinds of environmental rules that we make, but we go so far in pushing people. I will tell you, we just had somebody in the studio today from the Arizona Farm Bureau. Those are environmentalists. They use solar because it's necessary, not as some political badge of honor. They do things because it makes sense. You maintain the land the right way because you live off the land. You want to maintain the land because you farm the land. You're going to watch water. You're going to be very conservation focused because of water, because your cattle waters. You need water for cattle. You need water for your crops. These are the real environmentalists. You want to talk to people about the herds of game animals and the fish that we have. Talk to the hunters and the anglers whose money that they spend on licenses. Those are the real environmentalists. The political movement that this has turned into is turning people away. It's not bringing people in. You're turning people away from environmentalism. Your militant attitude toward anyone who disagrees with you or any data that doesn't line up with what you want it to say, you automatically ostracize and criticize those people, and you've driven people away from the idea of environmentalism. I guarantee you, when I said that I want to talk about Earth Day, there are people that just roll their eyes. Does that mean they don't care about the environment? They don't want clean air for their children and grandchildren. They don't want clean water. They don't want to make sure that the herds of game animals, if they're hunters, are as I guess they would say that they have just as many out there, that the herds are just as plentiful for their grandchildren as they were for them. They absolutely do, and they invest in it. The idea that the militant movement of environmentalists are the ones that are right is not true. We should have a thriving logging industry in Arizona. We should be able to thin the forests and clear the underbrush so that we can get to forest fires, so we don't have to have backburns and overhead fighting of fires and dropping in firefighters. That would be a way to slow down these big forest fires. I just think we need to rethink it. That's all. We're going to have our ballot breakdown in just a few moments. We are going to talk about how the impact of the trial of the former president and people not interested in this election. We're going to get to that coming up in a moment.